Very nice. I am supposed to rap on here several times to let the tape room know that we are going to talk and they are going to listen. This is the first forum of the summer season at Holden, and I thought that it might be appropriate to begin that with just a few remarks about forums at Holden, forums in general at Holden. At Holden, the forums are almost always on controversial issues. If the topic is not a topic on which reasonable people can disagree, there's probably not a good forum in it. So they're on controversial issues. They can be what Mary Schramm calls white knuckle sessions. If we've got a white knuckle session, we've probably got a good forum. If the topic is one on which reasonable people can justifiably disagree, then a good forum is one where a wide range of perspectives is shared. Everybody jumps in if it's a good forum at Holden, and one hopes for a spectrum of views on the topic. A good forum at Holden is one where an effort is made to come at the topic at hand as Christians. That is to say, how does Christian faith intersect the concern at hand? It's not a good Holden forum if we're not self-consciously trying to see the subject with eyes from the faith tradition. We've had forums at Holden where we talked about a subject for an hour and a half, and it might have taken place anywhere. It might have been a good forum elsewhere too. But a good forum at Holden is one where we self-consciously try to deal with the topic at hand, controversial though it may be, with the eyes that see from the tradition of Christian faith. Well, tonight's forum is on Reagan economics. What do you think? Mark Lund has been leading us in some sessions on economics this week. And Mark is available for this forum, not only as a participant, as all of us are, but also available to offer some help on technical economic questions when that kind of help is called for. So this forum might also have some questions and not only some comments, and Mark is available to supply some help there. Let me put before you where I think we are, just so that we're all on board with the news. I remind you that the Carter budget was one in which social welfare spending was to be decreased and defense spending was to be increased. We may have lost that in the shift to the Reagan budget. The Carter budget for this fiscal year, if he had been elected, was one which was the first budget of a Democratic administration to see an actual decrease in social welfare spending. But there was a troubled spirit with the Carter administration on economic affairs, and I want to read you what I think is an amazing quotation from Michael Blumenthal, who at that time was the Secretary of the Treasury in the Carter cabinet, and this is part of an address that he gave to the New York Financial Writers Association. He said, in part, "As financial and economic writers, you must find this a strange and difficult time. Reliable sources are no longer reliable. Those wonderfully complicated mathematical models of the economy have turned treacherous. They offer as many false leads as correct ones. The experts who know most about the economy now have the least certainty about it. The traditional crystal balls have been reduced to ground glass. Those who are most emphatic in their judgments and prognostications are almost without exception touched with arrogance and blessed with ignorance. Wisdom speaks in terms that are gray, hedged, and unquotable." This is a sitting Secretary of the Treasury I can imagine how hard it is to work up a strong lead or a new angle when you sit down at the typewriter. Well, I have no sympathy for you, because I have the exact same problem when I stand up at a podium like this. But if you and I have a problem, so do my colleagues and policymakers and decision makers and those who would like to be and those who are used to being that. These are tough times for all of us. It was a troubled spirit with the Carter administration and the economy. That has changed. That mood, that spirit has changed dramatically. And it is now, under Reagan, a bold spirit and a new economics, supply-side economics. And David Stockman, a former divinity student, hands out George Gilder's volume on wealth and poverty like Wes Priebe hands out popcorn. And George Gilder's volume is a kind of theology of supply-side economics. So it's a different spirit with the Reagan administration and a different economics. On Capitol Hill, the overall budget has been passed, and almost exactly as Reagan wanted. The task now on the Hill is to pass the particular appropriations, this much for the farm bill, this much for defense, etc., within the boundaries already targeted by the past budget. So Reagan on spending is getting as he wanted. The present debate, besides on appropriation, is on revenues, namely taking up the administration's proposal for tax cuts. The present debate is also on further spending cuts. So the discussion, for example, on Social Security. All right, that's just to kind of bring us to our awareness what's happening at present. You know all of that, but I just wanted to get it all out in front of us. Now to the discussion. This is a forum. How are we gonna go about it? How are we gonna get started? Maybe you want to pick up something from Mark's sessions, something that you wanted to ask but hadn't gotten the question out front yet. Maybe you want to discuss some particular aspects of Reagan's economics. So maybe you want to discuss the defense increase and inflation, or food stamps and the poor, or federal funds for college students, or something else. Or maybe your questions are ones of economic theory. Will Reagan's economics work? If it is passed by Congress and becomes the law and the administration of the land, will it in fact do what it says it is supposed to do? If the package goes through, will it bring down inflation and bring down unemployment? Or maybe you want to ask, what exactly is the need now? Is Reagan's economics the appropriate course of action for our particular economic needs? Or maybe you want to move right away into your declaration of your felt Christian conviction on Reagan's program. I like it because, as a Christian, it appears to me that, or I don't like it because, as a Christian, it appears to me that. Those are just all possibilities, and now is simply an invitation for some first comment on something or other, and then we're off. We won't sum it up at the end, we'll just quit at in about the time that we start Compline. It's wide open. Let's have somebody say something. As Erling Jorstad says, the second question usually...
I've got the first one.
All right, you got the first one. I should thank Erling for speaking up from up there. I sometimes forget to look to the balcony. You folks up there, just speak up, as Erling did. All right.
For some information, if I'm wrong, Mark, correct me, but in supply-side economics, the argument is that with the tax cut, 25, 30, whatever it is, that the money which is returned then to the taxpayer will be invested, which will improve productivity, which is bringing up the gross national product. Is that so far... the argument? Okay.
That's the argument behind it.
Now, what kind of empirical evidence is there that when the tax cut is made that people aren't going to hoard it or save it or buy a bigger car or do what the Reagan people say they're going to do with it? because it seems to me a real act of faith rather than depending on some sort of solid understanding of human nature that people are going to invest in blue chips or whatever it is rather than use it for the luxury goods which they've been denied for these years.
You want me to try to answer that?
Sure.
It's going to, that's such a loaded question, it's going to take a little while to answer it. Mm-hmm. First of all, an across-the-board tax cut, as Reagan is proposing, doesn't seem to please many people at all, at least economists, for some strange reason. I'm going to refer to a March 2nd Newsweek article in which they interviewed Paul Samuelson, who tends to be more of a liberal, and interviewed Milton Friedman, who's a conservative and really behind a lot of what Reagan is doing. And both of them don't like that plan very well. Friedman says that if you want to really channel that money that's returned, or if you want tax cuts, make sure that it leads to new investment and not to new consumption. And across the board, you're really going to do that. So Friedman's not very happy about that. That's the real thing. And so Friedman would say you need to have faster tax write-offs. You need to lower the income tax rates on people who are richer. Yep. That's how you really do that. Then when you ask Samuelson, will it happen? I think that was the question you're asking. Okay, if you do lower the tax rates, and if people save, that would be excellent. Because by putting that money into savings, we would hope that people would come in and borrow that money in savings and then invest it. So the issue isn't whether they save it or that people invest it in stocks themselves. The issue is whether when they get that money back, will they spend it on consumption. But here's why Samuelson's very discouraged and not very encouraged by the whole idea. In the early 1960s, a fellow by the name of Walter Heller, who was then chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors from the University of Minnesota, tried to do the same thing, across the board tax cut. It was the famous Kennedy tax cut. And what happened was when people got the money back, they did save some of it, and they put it in to the banking system, savings institutions. People borrowed it, and we took off in the 60s. Great growth. Now, they're proposing the same thing, but the people like Heller and Samuelson are saying, no. If you think it's going to work this time, it's only because you have an enormous amount of faith that something miraculous is going to happen, because it's not likely to happen. And I'll try and tell you why. We have a high rate of inflation right now, running in, well, still around 10%, 11%, even though it was way down last month, and it's expected to come back up again. In the early 60s, we did not have inflation. We had 1.5% inflation on the bad years. We had 2%, back to 1%. When you have inflation, how do you behave when you have inflation? We've got 10, 12% inflation. If you receive some money back from the government, what will you do? Will you save it, knowing that inflation's 10, 12%, and if you put it in a savings account, and it's not a big sum of money, you can get 6, 7, 8%. Not very likely that you'll save it. And so what people do during inflation is that there's little incentive to save, and if you do invest it, if you decide to invest it somewhere, not spend it, where do you put it? And where would you invest your money now? In some business that has a return of 5, 6%? You'll invest it maybe in land, thinking that'll go up, or in housing, because that'll go up. Or, of course, the dollar's a little sounder now. It's still really shaky. But you might invest it in gold, let's say, thinking that that's a better return. Well, you tend to put the money where you can make money in a hurry. And those types of assets do not produce goods and machines. A piece of land, even if you pay more for it, isn't going to produce any more crops. Or if you put it in gold or silver, it's not going to produce anything. Or you put it in housing. Houses don't produce anything. And so they're non-productive assets. So if you save the money, well, you're probably not going to save it. And if you do it, you'll invest it in something that isn't going to be productive. Then if, on the other hand, if you have high inflation, there's a real fallacy. It's called the fallacy of composition in economics. The best thing for the nation right now is not to spend a lot of money and spend it fast because we have inflation. But what's the best advice you can give an individual? If any of you came to me and said, I'm going to get a refund from the government, what would you advise me to do? I would say, as an individual, I would advise you to go out and spend that as fast as you can before it loses any purchasing power because of inflation. Now, if you're a good citizen, or maybe go try and bring in the Christian element, and you're going to worry about the well-being of the country, you'd probably say to them, save the money, because that's what the country needs. So you go out and save your money, a few of you, and everybody else gets the refund and goes out and spends it, pushing up inflation even more. And what was your reward for saving money, if only a few do it? It's the advice to the individual is so different from what's good for the whole nation. And I think that's why Samuelson's concerned. What will happen when you get the money back? Will you save it, or will you just go out and spend it? The tax cuts have to be carefully designed. Yes.
We have a more recent example of what we will do, and I haven't heard any summary of it at all. What did the people of California do after Proposition 13?
I can't answer that.
Fairly wealthy people saved lots of money, right?
Yeah.
In taxes?
Sure.
Is there no way to measure that? I'm just surprised that there hasn't been some analysis of that. That must be,
I don't know.
That would be right. Closer than the 60s. I think you're right, but I've been waiting to see what comes in from the economists.
Does anybody know? I haven't seen anything. I don't know if there's been study of follow-up on Proposition 13 from that.
It seems to me it shouldn't be that hard to look at the savings and loans or look at the purchasing or something in California as a state. I just can't imagine in an age of computers and we analyze everything that there isn't some feedback on that. But I have never read any.
Yeah.
Why doesn't the government give more incentives for saving? Is there a reason why they don't? Like for example, maybe a tax cut on interest from savings accounts. Is there economic reason why they don't do that?
It's certainly being discussed in certain places to make earnings on savings tax free. But inflation is relatively new in American economic history. I'm talking about since World War II, really. I mean, it's really starting to sink in. And they're trying to raise the interest rates on savings to try and encourage them and remove some of the savings that they placed on them. Why they haven't raised interest rates, my guess would only be that, this is sort of a guess, I guess. You raise the interest rates on savings and then we bring down inflation like everybody tells us we're going to do, and then what do you have? You might have a problem on your hands where you're paying very high interest on savings. And interest rates start to fall. I mean, it may be that. They thought they could solve the problem. They didn't take it very seriously, but there's much more discussion today.
At a bank in Chagrin Falls, Ohio, which is a small bank in no man's land, but there was a piece of paper that was posted that says, presently you're being taxed on the first $2,000. However, they're trying to get a list of people to raise that to $20,000, which would be like what you're saying. You would not be taxed until after the first $20,000 would be intended to save up that much in a variety of different banks.
We're not even at, Nancy, we're not even at the 2,000 now. That's the ad that you're supposed to send back in every Reader's Digest and every airport magazine. It's 200 now on stocks, but it's everything on interest.
$200 on savings.
Isn't that
savings this year.
I think one of the problems is that all of us are find it difficult to allow the rich to get any richer. You know, and a lot of the things that would help solve some of the problems, would do that. I think even the, non-taxing of savings, naturally it's going to help the people who have the money to save. You know, it's not going to help the person who doesn't have a savings account. And so everything, that the government, or a lot of things that the government could propose to help the economic situation right now are going to make the rich richer. And that's a very hard thing to swallow. And there's a lot of, people who say they don't want that. And yet, maybe that's what the country needs in order to more production going, more jobs, and help everybody that way. But it's a very hard thing to swallow.
And George Will had a column in the Washington Post in which he, in defense of the Reagan administration budget, just talked about attitudes of Americans who have concluded that rich is a four-letter word, which was his way of putting it.
One of the apparent contradictions in the Reagan program, it seems to me, has to do with in terms of the tax cut and tax advantages that might be offered. There has been a proposal in Congress for several years to do something to encourage people and corporations to do more supporting of charitable activity, nonprofit kinds of services, by increasing the deductible for that kind of contribution, even maybe a tax credit or a credit or what they call above the line deduction. I had some correspondence with all the congressional delegation from the metropolitan Kansas City area about that, trying to take a positive approach in the particular time that we're in. And interestingly, they all wrote back and said, yeah, this legislation is in Congress, but it doesn't appear that the administration really favors it. And I assume, trying to figure out why, it must be that the idea must be that although that would also offer a tax break to people, and would help encourage the private sector to undertake increased involvement in provision of human services, which is one of the main ideas, it must also be felt that human services are not productive in terms of the gross national product. So, charitable kinds of activity, such as the Lutheran Social Service Agency, for example. And I guess my question to Mark or Larry would be, or to anybody, is my assumption correct at that point? Is that one of those things that we're talking about this morning that does not show up in the GM?
Anything that passes through the market will show up in the GMP, or basically everything, except for some illegal activities. And, I'll tell you what I would, this is how I would respond, and it's not because I know of anybody in the administration saying that or I haven't heard what they're saying, but it's because I know how Milton Friedman would respond to that. Milton Friedman doesn't like the idea that corporations should take on some type of moral responsibility to the people around them. He says, what right does a corporation have to charge me extra money to buy the good so they can turn around and be the do-gooders with my money and decide where it's going? The individual should be able to decide where their money is going for charitable whatever endeavors. And for that reason, my guess is that Friedman would say, that's something we don't want to encourage, is corporations getting too involved in those kinds of things.
Apparently also are not encouraging to increase the individual taxpayers.
That was included in that too.
Mark, I had a question about the lowering of government regulations. And I guess I still really don't understand, in supply-side economics, the lowering of government regulations. A lot of those regulations came because people were being treated unfairly. I remember recently in Portland they had a car salesman who said, finally we're getting the governments off our backs. We can advertise a sale and we don't have to defend it and all of this and that. And the guy's really, I had some friends that went to him and he's really a dishonest dealer. And it seems to be that now a lot of these people are just being licensed for dishonesty. I don't understand how deregulation improves supply-side economics at the cost at the cost of so many consumers.
Okay, I'll give this one a try. Some might say that there are a few dishonest people in any business, and those people are the cause of all the regulations. So the government comes in and tries to protect the people from those, and that most of the people are not dishonest. And so those who run a good business, fair and honest, end up being penalized because of all of these regulations. And so if you're going to talk about the one person who isn't honest, I don't mean one, but the people who aren't honest, by removing the regulations, maybe it is giving a license to take advantage of the consumer.
I guess I thought of that the opposite way, that the regulations protected the honest guy so that the crooks wouldn't take all his business away.
Yeah, but if the system is working, maybe you know that he's a crook and others know that he's a crook, why does anybody deal with him?
Yeah, that's the next...
The system should eliminate that person.
But the regulations impose a large burden on the honest guys, because they have to meet the regulations. Maybe one of the answers, though, is that even if you get ripped off, if you get ripped off above board, that amount that you get ripped off adds to the gross national product.
Nice try.
That's not nice. I guess, being I'm not in business, I don't understand the regulations and how they affect people. But when I talk to people who are in business, and the stories they tell about which way their door has to open, and which way such and such has to go, and it goes on and on. There are a lot of people who really feel burdened down and feel like they're spending a lot of energy and time and investment in meeting those regulations, and it's taking money away from buying new equipment or whatever so that they can increase their productivity. And environment was probably a major example of that. But it's just been, the pastor of our church tells us all of the things that he has to do within the church structure to meet all of these government regulations. And he said, we spend money, we spend a lot of time, and that's not even the business that's really being aimed at by government in a lot of cases. So farmers talk about regulation, very unhappy with some of that. And I think it's just that extra burden that requires that you spend a lot of your, take a lot of your resources to meet those regulations, or it becomes so cumbersome that you can't even understand what's going on, so you don't even try to do it in the first place. It's those kinds of things that people feel slow down our chances of increasing productivity. But you're right, when you remove regulations, you are opening the door for some people to take advantage. And Milton Friedman, as you mentioned, would say, well, if they're going to take advantage, hopefully the system will work in a way in which people will say that person's dishonest and we're getting taken advantage of and will soon be out of business. How carefully they can disguise their rip-offs or whatever it is. I'm sure there are many who are good.
Other angles at Reagan economics, or other topics within that you want to pick up?
I'm confused about this, that the system should eliminate the dishonest person, because maybe I have a wrong stereotype, but I thought that's how the Carnegies and the Rockefellers got rich and got all the money. I don't know. Is that a myth?
Being Milton Friedman's the one who says that the dishonest person would be eliminated, I'll go back and use some of his arguments to explain why he would say that the Carnegies and the Rockefellers, et cetera, became very rich. He would say it was because of the government in the first place. The government was able to grant favors, sometimes with good intentions and bad consequences, sometimes just because they were corrupt. And that much of that happened because of bad government, not because of what was going on in the private sector. And for that reason, he says the best thing to do is eliminate the role of the government as much as possible from the economic sector, because then there's no place for the businesses to go to get all of these special favors, special laws, special considerations for what they're doing or favors, and they're going to just have to compete with the consumer in the private sector. And to what extent you can eliminate the government from the economy, certainly. Debatable, but that would be a response, I think, on the part of Friedman.
And some of it would be, again, our own greed, I think, by taking the example of the car salesman. If we, even though we know that he's dishonest, but he's going to offer us a special deal today only for $500 less, and we think, wow, I'm going to buy it, even though, I know that it's going to be a lemon, and then we end up with a lemon, and then we complain about it. But it's our greed, in a sense, of going ahead wanting the 5 cents off or the $500 off and then allowing that person to stay in business.
Well, without making any judgment, I wonder how valid really truly the tax decrease proposal is going to be when in fact the Reagan budget has cut back in many of the funding areas that are out there in the various states, to cities and municipalities and various agencies. They in turn are laying off police, firemen, they're cutting back services. it seems to me that in reality, that if we, the public, are going to get services that we want from our various municipal agencies, we're going to have to look at raising our own local taxes. And it seems to me it's a matter of shifting the burden back to the local.
Mm.
That's what's happening, rather than giving us any decrease.
No,
it's really making us come up short, and we'll have to raise our own taxes locally.
Not only that, but I have a confusion, and you can help clarify. As I understand Reagan's tax proposals, they are not a rollback or a decrease, such as we think in terms of Proposition 13. Rather, he has said, we are going to do more in taxes, but with my cut in the tax rate, you won't pay as much as you would have.
Mm-hmm.
They're reducing the rate of growth in taxes.
Yeah. So I don't see that there's any money being saved. I mean, anything that's being returned to the pot is invisible at the moment, it looks to me.
I think part of the thing that gets confused in that is the whole idea of inflation. Because of inflation, you move into higher income brackets,
mm-hmm.
and you end up paying more. So to say that you're paying more taxes, it also means you're getting more income next year. So it may be that there is going to be some extra money. I mean, just to see, how can I restate that? Next year, your income goes up by 10%, so you move into higher tax brackets. Well, you're going to end up paying more taxes, but because your income's gone up, you're going to have more money to spend. And so the issue is, what do you do with the marginal, that increase? That's important. But your point's really interesting, because not only would we be shifting possibly the tax burden, if it turns out that the states and the local municipalities decide to pick up some of those services that have been dropped, you're paying all of those taxes, plus we're paying for a much larger military expenditure force. And so I want to raise a point too on these taxes. The question was asked, who's going to be hurt by the tax cuts? And Milton Friedman said, the way he interprets it, I wish I knew more about the real technical parts of those tax cuts and what it looks like, but Milton Friedman said, and this is wild, he said, the people who are going to be hurt least are those who are poorest, and those who are richest will be hurt the most. And then Samuelson said, no, those who are richest will be helped the most by the tax cuts, and those who are poor are really going to be hurt by it. Now, again, I don't know the numbers or the specifics, but they have two economists look at the same information. Well, that's part of your introduction, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
And to respond so differently is really amazing.
We listen to two politicians do that, right, for the election.
Yeah, I don't know.
Listen to two preachers do it.
What logic does Friedman use to back that up? Just a bigger piece of the pie or two?
No, I wish I knew. I don't even know. I don't understand. Unless it's that the poor already don't pay many taxes, and therefore, if you raise the brackets or make it a little or lower the taxes, or you have more deductibles, you end up being a little better off.
And make yourself have to trickle down.
Yeah, that I think is probably more of an issue of debate, is the idea of trickle down. Are people willing to go with the tax cuts and hopefully have them designed to increase investment and capital accumulation in ways which really favor the rich, thinking that it will trickle down to those who are poor? That's a real debate. And secondly, what Reagan is doing is really putting a halt to more concern for welfare and a more of a humanitarian interest in the society, and we're saying we're changing our whole philosophical understanding of what the economy is all about, and we're changing direction and moving back and saying too much welfare, and we need to go back to more inequality. And those are some, I think those are some issues that are real, really at the heart of what's going on.
Maybe those are the issues we should be discussing. If two top economists can't even agree what's going to happen with this tax cut, who's going to get hurt? I haven't even seen people agree on how much it's going to be, looking at the same law. Maybe we shouldn't argue about whether it's going to work or what's going to happen or who's going to have more money. Maybe the only thing we as Christians can argue about is the spirit behind it, or the intent behind it, or the effect on the spirit of our nation. Because the details, better people than I haven't been able to figure out.
If
Mark, you were saying something about the Reagan economic plan being a kind of shift back towards inequity as opposed to a concern for equity and the old Keynesian approach. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, because I think that Reagan really honestly truly believes that this is the best economic system supply side, and that in its workings it will eventually trickle down to those at the lower rungs of the economic ladder, and they will eventually get a bigger piece of pie. He truly believes that. So it isn't as though it's a let them eat cake philosophy. He really believes it, and he is a compassionate person. But at the same time, you have to sit back and say, well, will it work? And that's where I guess I'm concerned. I just don't see how it can work. It certainly isn't going to trickle down, because it never has. That's why Keynesian economics developed in the first place.
Well, one of the advantages of the present situation is, like this gentleman said over here, is that it's going to force the local jurisdiction take a bigger role in welfare, all of the various programs, and it'll be probably a more honest dollar doing it. And that's the big problem with the federal government is that they just pump out more money, and that's of course part of the problem too. That, I mean, every program that they can afford, they do it on the basis of deficit spending. And now once it gets down to the local jurisdictions, they can't do that. Even just towns around here, Spokane, Wenatchee, some of the areas, they're facing some real problems because they can't even borrow money or don't want to borrow money for fear of hurting their credit rating. And so they're talking of furloughs for city employees. And I mean, at that point, you can't print money, at the local level, or you can at the federal level.
One worry, Werner, has been whether local jurisdictions are set up and capable of handling all kinds of problems that the federal government has addressed before, such as welfare. And that's certainly one worry that is expressed with the Reagan administration's proposals for block grants to states and so on. Whether you have at the local level the infrastructure and the offices and the personnel to handle a lot of problems that were previously addressed nationally. That's another side of those who would argue that it's a good thing. There's a lot of worry that the capacity isn't there.
Well, that's where maybe the further investment will have to come.
Yeah.
It's not meaning that I think any time a major readjustment takes place, that there's going to be some real trauma and
sure.
hurt. And, even this is, I think, where the churches have, have given up part of their role. I mean, it's been very easy for the churches to say, well, the government is going to take care of our own, and therefore we don't have to anymore. Well, I think the churches all of a sudden are going to have to say in the communities, part of our offerings are going to have to take care of, the people who go to our congregations, plus those who don't go to any congregations. I mean, that, as I see it, was part of the original purpose of the Christian
fellowship. We haven't done that. So I think we just assumed that the government was going to do it, and so we spent money in the church on other things. That would be good if that, I think, that point, if that happens, but I wonder, the whole tone in the country is not to do that, because that's how Reagan got elected anyway. We know everybody's saying these lazy people. I mean, that's what I hear. They're just taking our money, and I want to keep my money. And so that's what concerns me more than Reagan and his policies, is that that's what everybody wants anyway. And I don't know if they're going to pick up. I mean, the states are cutting back, they're following the lead, and that's what the people want.
I really agree with you on that. I think the mood is very much across the board in churches and in state government and local government to cut back, reduce services, and expenditure, particularly human welfare services. We did some analysis that said if just for the church community in the Metropolitan Kansas City to replace the funds that will be lost in the reduction of one program alone, food stamps, would cost something like $4 to $5 million in the balance of this year. That's just one reduction. Well, you know, we're talking to the town for our needs. We're saying the churches are going to pick this up.
Well, yeah, but aren't there other ways? I don't know, you know, how that analysis was made. Is that strictly dollar for dollar, or if we get back again to what do they used to call it some years ago, where they would, well, I guess they still do them, but, you know, bring food into the
commodity country. Foods.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there are ways through volunteer service, through produce that can be shared, you know, can make up some of the gap in food stamps.
Yeah, I think it can be done. I agree.